I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the first headliners of this new year. I hope you had a great holiday season. It's still a little quiet around campus. The students don't actually come back to class for a couple more weeks, so the elevators go up and down really fast. Congratulations to all of you for not letting the snow and cold keep you from getting to tonight's important discussion of America's involvement in Afghanistan. Wow. How about that? Yeah, right. Freudian slip for sure. Anyway, we're glad you're here. It is an important discussion, and you're quite a dedicated community of learners. We always look forward to this month. We're growing in size every month, too, which is a very exciting thing, and you may notice that we're starting to stretch the capacity of the room. So for that reason, let me give you a little advance notice about the fact that we're expecting an even larger crowd perhaps next month when our speaker is going to be former U.S. Vice President Walter Mondale. Seriously. No snow. We're not going to have any snow. Each spring for the past 3 years, Mr. Mondale has co-taught an undergraduate course on national security issues with political science professor Larry Jacobs. How timely is that, huh? And you've seen Larry in here before. He does a terrific job. So they both agreed to join us in February to give you a preview of the truly remarkable learning experience that they provide over at the Humphrey Institute in the spring. So let me encourage you to reserve your tickets in advance so you don't miss this opportunity to meet one of Minnesota's most legendary public figures, to say the least. Last month, President Obama announced his long-awaited strategy for America's continuing involvement in Afghanistan. After 8 years of military action, his decision to increase troop levels set off a round of very vigorous debates on both sides of the aisle. But while many expressed strong opinions about the war and effort in Afghanistan, few understand the country's ancient culture and history. So fortunately for us, tonight's speaker is an expert on the conflict between Islam and the West, and he's just returned from the region recently. Professor Iraj Bashiri is a native of Iran. He came to the United States as a graduate student and received both a master's degree and PhD in linguistics from the University of Michigan. In 1972, he joined the faculty of the University of Minnesota, where he serves as a professor of Islamic intellectual history. Professor Bashiri's scholarship on Iranian language and literature is internationally renowned and has earned him an honorary doctorate in history and culture from Tajikistan State University. In 1997, he was elected an honorary member of the Academy of Sciences of Tajikistan. At the University of Minnesota, he's the recipient of the College of Liberal Arts Distinguished Teaching Award. Currently, he's at work on a book tentatively titled, this sounds fascinating, The Roots of Conflict Between Islam and the West, Interplay of Faith and Reason. So please join me in welcoming Professor Iraj Bashiri.
Thank you very much, Dean Nichols. I'm very happy to be here and be with an audience. I think that the way I understand, I've listened to some of the previous presentations, are very much involved in world politics, and I'm very happy to share with you some of my ideas about Afghanistan. It's a country that really needs a lot of help, and also soon show you why that is the case. excuse me. If you were to ask an Afghan in the 18th century where Afghanistan belongs in the world, that is the map that would tell you where he thought it would. In the center of the world is Afghanistan. To its west is India, to its east is Russia, and then you have Iran in the north and China to the south. That is how they thought Afghanistan was located in the world. Around 1800, if you were to actually look at the Afghan world, that's what we would see. There was no country called Afghanistan. What there was a region which was located in Mawar-un-Nahr, which means beyond the Oxus River, and you had India on one side and Persia on the other side. What is in the center there is what would be eventually Afghanistan. It was settled by nomads, basically, and there were some settlements like Balkh, Ghazna, Kandahar, Kabul, that is now the capital city, Quetta, and so forth. So that is the makeup of Afghanistan as it was at that time. If you were to look at the same region from a linguistic or ethnological point of view, we have a number of tribes, some of them large, some smaller, of nomadic people living in the area that would be, again, Afghanistan. In the south, you have the Pashtun, and we are on topic, talk about them. In the center, in green, you have the Hazargi. To the west of them, the lighter green, are the Parsiwan, which are related more or less to the Iranians. To the north, in yellow, you have the Tajiks, and then their neighbor to the west, the Uzbeks, and then in orange, you have the Turkmens. So that is the makeup of the region. Pashtuns, Turkmens, Tajiks, and Hazaragis. Hazaragis are basically Mongols from 13th century still living in central Afghanistan. Then around 1700, both in St. Petersburg and London, they started to look at Central Asia in general and Afghanistan in particular for resources. And as you know, the Indian continent was under British rule, and at the time that we are talking about, Russia was fighting the Crimean War. What is the game that we're talking about, the great game as it is called, is that British India starts to move up, if you look at the map, from the south and in the direction of what would be Afghanistan. Everything was pretty much taken care of until they got to Afghanistan. Then the trouble began. There were three wars for the British in Afghanistan. The first one, they lost 16,000 of their troops. In other words, they moved from India into Afghanistan. They captured Kabul. They thought everything was right. But on the way back to India, 16,000, some fled, I would say. The whole contingent was wiped out. That is the type of war that we have, or warriors that we are dealing with. The second war also was kind of a loss for the British. All they could get out of that was they captured Kabul, Kandahar, and so forth, but they had to leave. And the only thing they got was the control over the foreign affairs of Afghanistan. That they needed that because they wanted to know what the Iranians and the Russians are doing. The third war in 1919 was also usually considered to be a loss. And out of that, they got what is called the Durand Agreement, and I'll talk about that shortly. And the Afghans got the control for their foreign affairs back. So these are the three wars. Now, there were two treaties that were of great importance. One is called the Panj Treaty. And that is when Russia is done with the Crimean War and begins to move in the direction of Central Asia. And as you can see in the map here, gradually they move south in the same way that the British were moving north. And these two movements, as if on a chessboard happening, has given this the name of the Great Game. So somebody sitting in London, somebody sitting in St. Petersburg say, move one more this way or that way. That is the Great Game. The Emir of Bukhara had two battles with the Russians, and he lost both in 1868 and Bukhara became a vassal of Russia. And then the emir, on behalf of the Russia, signed a treaty which put the Panj River, that's the river north of Afghanistan of today, called the Panj River, as the boundary between the Afghans, or what would be Afghanistan, and the northern tribes of the region of Central Asia. And in the south, then we have the Durand line that is drawn, and that divides the Pashtun area into half. So what you have for Afghanistan today is the remnants of Tajiks in the north, that's the yellow, what is now in Afghanistan, Uzbeks, again, southern part of Uzbekistan of today, Turkmens, the southern part of Turkmenistan of today, and half of the Pashtuns. So what we have in Afghanistan is a patchwork of tribes, half of which is somewhere else. And that is one of the major problems that the Afghans have. This is the country that was created by the Durand Line and the Panj Treaty between the two superpowers of the time. And this picture very nicely shows my good friends. Also, I should say that the Durand Line is what creates a big divide. And as a result of that, the people of the region are not happy with those who did this to them. This is a long time ago, but Afghans are known for not forgetting things. So looking at Afghanistan today, that's what we have. In the south, we have 42% Pashtuns, half in Pakistan now, half in Afghanistan. We have 27% Tajiks and 9% Uzbeks and so on. So that's the composition. Language, there are two major languages. One is Pashto and the other one is Dari. And Turkic languages are involved in the case of Turkmenistan. As far as religion is concerned, they are Sunni of the Hanafi faith, 80%, and Ismaili, mostly Shiite Ismailis, about 19%. And the population now is about 29 million. Now, the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan is of great interest, even though, as you see on the map here, Afghanistan is a patchwork itself and has many warlords and tribal chiefs. The Soviets decided that they would take this country under their wing, as they had other republics that we have later coming up. So that was an effort that they wanted to make Afghanistan one of their republics. And as we know, in 1980s, it spelled disaster for them. And I'm going to spend the rest of this period talking about basically the history of Afghanistan to see what kind of things happened there. King Amanullah is known for the type of Eastern person who wants to travel west and show himself to everyone as the representative of a modern Afghanistan, in the same way that Ataturk or Reza Shah of Iran at the time were showing themselves as progressive rulers. So that's Amanullah for you. He gained the independence of Afghanistan, adopted a constitution in 1923, established the Loya Jirga. Loya Jirga is like a parliament. It is a combination of tribal and warlords who make decisions for Afghanistan, or made decisions at the time for Afghanistan. Abolished religious endowments or waqf, which is something that he should not have done, and promoted modern agriculture and industry. In addition, he elevated the status of women, and we know what the situation with women is today, and we are talking about the 1920s. overhaul the educational system that is open new schools taught by foreigners, making attendance obligatory, introduce courses in medicine, agriculture, architecture, economics, music, and so forth, to the point that they could send students abroad from Afghanistan to come back and, of course, help. Establishment of secular courts of justice, because usually in these countries it's the religious sector that is in charge. Curtailment of the authority of the tribal chiefs and the clergy, and those are the two major powers in the country. Recertification of the mullahs, that is the clergy, had to show that they know what they are talking about before they would become certified. Introduction of mixed education for boys and girls, which even today is impossible in Afghanistan, but he attempted that. And ban polygamy, that's, as you know, in Islam you can have up to four wives and as many concubines. Now forcing people to have only one wife at that time was quite hard. And abolishing the burqa, which is tied to a lot of things, including the honor of the person and the society. So these are tough measures that he took, and he paid for it. Initial opposition came from the clergy. They labeled him an enemy of Allah and his reforms against the Quran and the Sharia. Right there, you can see the type of problem that exists in a country like Afghanistan if you were to implement reforms. Tribal chiefs joined in and demanded full authority over their wives and their daughters. And they wanted the schools the way they were now configured to be closed. And they did not want the mullahs to be recertified. Of course, those are the ones who help them do what they want to do. The opposition was led by a barefoot brigand casually referred to as Bachir Sakao, which means the water carrier's boy. And we have his picture right here. At an impasse, King Amanullah abdicated, and the rulership of Afghanistan went to Bachir Sakao. His attempt foreshadows the revolution in Iran, the 1979 revolution, Islamic revolution in Iran, the coming of the Mujahideen to Afghanistan, and the coming of the Taliban to Afghanistan. So if you knew your Afghan world well, you would know that that's what the consequence for some of the actions. Here is, we have Bachir Sakao, who ruled only 6 months as the main ruler of Afghanistan. And here we have him a few months later, him and his family. U.S.-Afghan relations have a long history, as I have been saying. The Soviets started helping the Afghans very, very early in the game. In 1919, however, talking about relations with the United States, we find the Afghans coming to the United States twice for help, at least for friendship, and both times they are rejected. I have a letter here that indicates the type of relationship they wanted, basically. It says, I sincerely wish to establish a permanent friendly relation between Afghanistan and the high government of the United States. That's King Amanullah's second attempt at becoming friends with the United States. The answer is pretty much a no. The question of the creation of a diplomatic mission and of the appropriate action to that end by the Congress of the United States must be reserved for further consideration. So very nicely put, no. The Russians, or the Soviets, I should say, on the other hand, as we can see, helped in any way that was possible. in 1919, they were the first to recognize the independence of Afghanistan. Then they had friendship treaties signed with Afghanistan, Kabul-Tashkent air transport agreement, non-aggression treaty, and gradually started to help Afghanistan by donating various things to them, including flour mills, here 3.5 million. And today when we say million, it's not a whole lot, but at that time a million was a lot when you think about it, and other things as things went on. Afghans felt that this help with the Soviet Union is eventually get them into trouble, so maybe a balance should be created with the United States. So they came to the United States for help again. They asked to create an alternate transit route for them. In 1950, the Pashtun situation was before them, and they had difficulty with Pakistan, and they could not have transit through Pakistan, which is their east and south, and they did not want through Iran, so the Soviets helped there. And they also asked for a loan to pave the streets of Kabul. But I think these were mostly asking for a balance, some help out of the Soviet camp, but they were denied both times. 1955, road construction budget for Afghanistan on the Soviet side, 2.1 million. Support for Pashtunistan, granting of transit that they were asking from the United States. Large arms agreements. Actually, they became the first or the only supplier. Funds for Kabul streets that were asked were denied. Power plants, Hindu Kush highway, airfields, irrigation canals, and dams. And there were medical and educational exchanges between the two. Oil prospects, 1.5 million. Gifts, hydro turbines, other gifts. So, in other words, they were spending on Afghanistan much more than at the time they were spending on some of their southern republics. The Kandahar Highway is 129 million that they spent. Five-year plan, 195 million. Kabul housing project, credits, and so forth. Nuclear reactor, 17 million. Again, credit for natural gas extraction, 39 million. The Hindu Kush highway was completed at this time. Now, a major feature of the Hindu Kush highway is what is called the Salang Tunnel. Now, this is a major tunnel and helps a great deal. If you look at the map here, if you were to go from the northern areas of Afghanistan, say to Kabul, you had to go that whole circle. You go up north and then south around the mountain until you get to Kabul. That's 4 years' journey. The Salang Tunnel in the red there is what the Soviets created. It's meters high, so you can see what just the difficulty of creating a tunnel like that is. 2.6 kilometers long. Its width is 7 and height 7 meter, 1,000 vehicles per day. So that made a lot of help, a lot of contribution to Afghan life. Now, my question for you is, why we're doing this? This is a picture of the Salang Highway itself. It's a very nice tunnel. Soviet objectives. Eventual inclusion of Afghanistan in the Soviet Union. Assuring Afghanistan's neutral stance vis-a-vis the United States and People's Republic of China. Showcasing the viability of Communist International. Maintenance of trade relations with the Afghans and what they always, the Russians, before the Soviets wanted was access to warm water seas. Those were the reasons for spending all that money on Afghanistan. Soviet assistance benefited the city of Kabul the most. With its university, colleges, hotels, and elegant houses, the capital city of Kabul became a true showcase of progress in the region. Even in the back alleys, there were images of Western men and women advertising eyeglasses. On the door there says, "Please leave your bike by the brook," in case you wonder what that says. And here's the city of Kabul. It's a beautiful place. If you ever want to go, hopefully in the future, by the Kabul River. And in the 1960s, they traveled there. That's what we see. Elegant houses. You think about it today. It's almost like a hotel. It's where you get your car to or bus to go to various parts of the city. Kabul River is just in the forefront of the picture. After much hard work by the Soviets and the Afghans, we had 10 faculties at the university, 22 colleges, 31 professional schools, 52 high schools, 533 elementary schools, 788 rural schools, and 26 Islamic schools. Altogether, we had 1,436 schools, and that's what they had a hard time earlier on to have under Amanullah Khan. 235,000 students with a ratio of 1 to 7, girls over boys. 5,983 teachers. 14,719 graduates, 229 out of Kabul University. 907 professional school graduates, 1,743 high school graduates. In addition to that, you had 1,000 Afghan teachers studying abroad, and 2% of the population literate. Afghanistan at the time had 15 million, a population of 15 million. It had 59 hospitals, 5 maternity wards, 5 sanitariums for TB, 19 labs, 18 x-ray facilities, 2,111 beds, 250 doctors, and 69 assistant doctors. That's something that I sometimes have a hard time to associate with Afghanistan, but life was very good, and I should say the Soviets did help a great deal. They helped a great deal, I should give them credit here, and they did a great deal in Central Asia that I work with all the time. And Central Asia would be like Afghanistan today if they had not helped, except they had an ulterior motive here that did not work for them. Just let me give you the ratio here per doctor. 50,000 Afghans per one doctor, while in Iran of that time was 8,000 and in Turkey was 4,000. Now this is where the confrontation begins. The friendship between the Afghans and the Soviets lasted as long as the Soviets built roads, airports, and irrigation canals. But when, during the prime ministership of Daoud Khan in 63, communist cells were formed and sacred tenets of Islam, the divinity of Allah, the Prophet of Muhammad, the authority of the Quran, and the centrality of prayer were threatened, the clergy's tolerance gave way to an uncompromising confrontation with the Soviets. Introduction of land reform and emancipation of and education of women was what broke the camel's back. So this is where the actual downhill movement for Afghanistan begins, and this is what we have left of the elegant houses and nice streets that we just saw. In 1979, the specter of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, supported by Iran, loomed large. To safeguard its assets and for other reasons, the Soviets moved into Afghanistan. Within a short time, the country fell apart. Each tribal chief or regional warlord carved out a portion of the country as his own fiefdom and defended it against the Soviets. The Soviets, helped by their party leaders and their military commanders, confronted the Afghans. And of course, Afghans were no match for the Soviets. And that's where Americans come in. The factors that helped the Afghans gain their independence included American funds, $5 billion by 1992, and military assistance, 1,000 Stinger missiles in 1 year, 86, 87. The revival of the Mujahideen Corps. Now, the Mujahideen Corps, I will come back hopefully later and talk about, is those Pashtuns and Tajiks and so forth who were divided many, many years ago, and they were still there, their descendants. The participation in the war of Muslims from around the world, including Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. So these are the forces that brought the Soviets down. In 1989, Gorbachev moved all Soviet troops out of Afghanistan. In 1991, he resigned, and the Soviets, Soviet Union fell apart, and of course the specter of communism also disappeared. And with that disappeared also the promises that the United States had given the Afghans that after the war, everything would be fine. After the Soviets and the Americans left, two factions vied for power. General Najibullah is the person the Soviets left in charge of the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan and the Mujahideen Islamic State of Afghanistan, the ones who were fighting the Soviets. And both of these were really powerless in one way or the other. Najibullah had authority, but no power. The Mujahideen had the power, but no authority. So Afghanistan went down as they fought each other for supremacy. In Pakistan, Afghanistan's chaotic situation forced Prime Minister Bhutto to take action. She mobilized the Taliban to put an end to the atrocities of the Mujahideen. In 1994, the Taliban captured Kandahar and gradually took over other provinces as the Mujahideen surrendered. In 1996, they captured Kabul and consolidated their power. What did they want to do? What kind of society they wanted? For women, they said women should stay home and attend the family matter. They must not wear white socks. And must be fully veiled. Women are not allowed to go out of the house without a chaperone. For men, they have to wear beards. Sports, no more buzkashi, no more flying kites, no more soccer. For religion, the Shia were kind of not accepted. Shia was not accepted as a religion, and the Hazaras of Afghanistan also were known as non-Muslims. They actually killed 11 Iranians who are Shiite. Now, after the Taliban, I've been giving lectures about after the Taliban for the last 20 years, so this is one of them. The Mujahideen reorganized themselves into the United Islamic Front, with Burhanuddin Rabbani, who always wanted to be called Dr. Burhanuddin Rabbani, as their leader. Ahmad Shah Massoud became prime minister, and other commanders
Dustum, Fahim, and Ismail Khan of Herat. These were the ones who were then to fight the Taliban. With the assistance of the United States, the UIF's northern branch defeated the Taliban. In 2004, Hamid Karzai was elected president of Afghanistan. So this is a very short history of what went on and what stakes were involved. Now, why Afghanistan? There are a number of reasons. Until recent times, as I said, the territory of Afghanistan had never been home to a nation. Its people are semi-nomadic, uneducated in Islam, and about Western culture. It's one of the nesting places and recruiting centers for Al-Qaeda. Pashtun ideology requires Afghans to give asylum to the likes of bin Laden and al-Zawahiri. The Taliban intend to use their ample resources in narcotics, precious stones, and assistance from their Pakistani and international allies to wear down Pakistan and seize its nuclear arsenal. Also, Afghanistan is near the Ferghana Valley, where a fundamentalist group, the IMU, seeks world domination under a caliph. So those are the reasons, and I'll stop here for any questions that there might be.
In the back is our first question.
Thank you. My question is regarding the diversity you have with Afghanistan, as we hear with U.S. policy, potential U.S. policy in Iraq, to divide the country into three with a Kurdistan north and then a Shiite middle and a Sunni south. Is there any push in Afghanistan to do the same thing, connecting the north to Uzbekistan, the northeast to Tajikistan, give the south central or southwest to Pakistan, and leave the central sort of an independent country to keep it hegemonous?
There was a move in the 1950s that could have done that, and that is called the Pashtunistan situation. Pashtunistan, as we talked, is in two parts. Half of it is now in Pakistan, half of it is in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, of course, thinks that all Pashtunistan should be in Afghanistan, and Pakistan thinks all Pashtunistan should be in Pakistan. But the Pashtuns think that they should be separate, a country by themselves. Any way you look at it, Afghanistan falls apart. And if that were to happen, that division that you just mentioned with the Tajiks and Turkmens and so forth would make sense. But they have been against that. So I don't think there is any move in that direction.
Thank you. We have a question over here on the right.
What is the reason the United States did not offer friendship early in the 1900s?
I think we should ask them, but my feeling is that Afghanistan at the time did not have anything to offer. I have a hard time understanding why not friendship. The only thing I can see is that after friendship is gimme. They needed assistance, probably. And at that time, there was no reason for the United States to spend money, funds there, knowing that the Soviets were. Maybe that was the right thing to do at the time, to counter the Soviets, but they didn't feel, I think, at that time that the Soviets would make anything in Afghanistan, even if Afghanistan was included. But it's later on when communism becomes a major factor that Afghanistan changes from what it was to what it is.
We have a question in the back here.
It seems to me that our problem today is relatively insoluble, but what we're trying to do is prevent the resurgence of the Taliban. And it seems to me that the core thing for the Taliban, or the basic thing for the Taliban, is the financial support that they gain from the narcotics trade.
Right.
And it seems to me that this country needs to take a more sensible view of what we do for drugs, because we will never stamp out this trade. What we need to do, it seems to me, is do one of two things. We need to cut off the buyer so that there's no money in it. And that means we either need to legalize it or take a Singaporean approach. And if you're caught with heroin, we'll just hang you. So I guess what my question is, if we get the Taliban out, take the money out of the heroin, will the Taliban go away? Will this become just a provincial conflict between the various groups that are trying to take over the country? Or are we going to have some other group that comes in and provides a similar kind of Islamic desire, Al-Qaeda support, promotes terrorism, etc.? But I think we should take away the funding or call heroin use treason and treat that as a capital crime.
Well, I think the answer to that is, who are the Talibans? I haven't seen anyone writing over here Taliban. The Talibans are Afghans. They are as warriors Afghans, as helpers Afghans, as those who plant opium Afghans. So their whole life is tied to the two resources that they have, precious stones and narcotics. Unless we can create some kind of alternative to that, and they have tried a number of times and have failed, an alternative way of life in Afghanistan, that will not go away. And I feel by just stamping out Taliban, nothing will happen, because there is no community in Afghanistan known as the Taliban. There are some people who are creating a lot of problems, and they are not just in Afghanistan, they are in Africa. We just know Yemen, as of yesterday, they're back again. They are in various parts in Europe. So the problem is much bigger than what we look at, or in Iraq. The problem is much bigger than just giving it credit that it's something that's happening in Afghanistan and that can be solved by going to Afghanistan and dealing with it.
We have a question over in the back here, and then a number over here.
What role does India play, and does the tension between Pakistan and India have a role in this?
As far as I know, they are trying to be friendly with both sides, but I haven't seen anything. The difficulty that India has, I think India has problems with Pakistan, and therefore they try to stay out of this as much as possible. That's the way I see it.
Some few weeks ago, some of us heard the mother of Greg Mortensen talk about his experiences with his Central Asia Institute in building the schools. And she was saying that of the schools that he has built in Afghanistan and Pakistan, they've not had any problem at all. But the schools that the government has built in these different villages have all been pretty much destroyed. Do you think that if more effort was made, like what Mr. Mortensen, the gentleman who wrote Three Cups of
right.
Tea, would make much difference?
I think it would make much difference. I think what we don't understand about Afghanistan is what the first ruler, one of the first rulers of Afghanistan, Amanullah Khan, didn't understand, what the Soviets didn't understand, what the British didn't understand. It is an Islamic country, and we should not forget that. Amanullah forgot it's an Islamic country, went and did all these reforms, and we had the Bacha Sakao, the water carrier boy. The Soviets, they had their motives, went in, built a beautiful Afghanistan, and we saw what happened to that. Because, again, they went against the tenets of Islam. Everything was fine, as long as they were helping and building. But once you come to Islam, Afghans become a totally different type of person. They have their own Islamic culture, and they have their own Islamic way of life, which unfortunately has got a lot added to it,
and is no longer a religion. And if I had time, maybe I have enough time just to show you a little bit of what Islam is and what Islam in Afghanistan has become. And these are two different things. First, let me share with you some of the other things that Taliban don't like. No more kite flying. Employment, education, and sports for women. Movies, television, videos, music, dancing, hanging pictures in homes, clapping during sports events, beard trimming, pork, pig, lobster, pig oil, anything made from human hair, nail polish, satellite dishes, cinematography, equipment that produces the joy of music, pool tables, chess, masks, alcohol, tapes, computers, VCRs, statues, sewing catalogs, pictures, Christmas cards, anything that propagates sex and is full of music, wine, firecrackers. Men should wear beards extending farther than a fist clamped at the base of the chin. And that's why you see these Afghans with the beards that we see. Men's hair should be short and should wear a head covering. Depiction of living things, drawings, paintings, photographs, stuffed animals, dolls, all of these things are prohibited. And the punishments for some of these are drastic, for theft, amputation of a hand. And you see many Afghans today that lost their hands not because of the war, but because of theft. Rape and murder, public execution, married adulteries, stoned to death. So those are some of the punishments. Now, looking at ideology in Afghanistan, we have Zoroastrianism, which is the base of the religion. And I'll look at this a little bit just to give you an idea of what is going on. Hanafi Islam, Afghan Pashtunwali, Pan-Islamism, Diobandi, Wahhabism, and Jihadism. You hear these a lot, but usually they don't make sense. But these are ingredients in the ideology that gives you the kind of prohibitions I just showed you. Zoroastrianism believes in good thoughts, good words, good deeds. Conflict between good and evil. We should assist good to triumph over evil. We should respect environment and animals. That's the base before the coming of Islam. The Afghans are Sunni Muslims and of the Hanafi sect. And Hanafism teaches tolerance and dependence on reason. This is the base of Afghan thinking before all of this. Accepts qiyas, which is analogy, and rai, which is individual opinion. Now, this is the Islamic Sharia. I don't want to go over that, but I just want to show you what the belief system is like. Belief in God, angels, books, prophets, and I say books, prophets, not just one. Decree of God, and day of judgment. The kinds of things that they want to be in their society for moralities, sincerity, confidence in God, humility, patience, resignation, and down the line. All very positive things that are in all religions. So Islam that existed in Afghanistan had these elements. Beyond that, you have the prayers and going to Mecca and fasting and things like that. Alongside that, the Afghans have what is called Pashtunwali. This comes to Afghanistan, not comes to Afghanistan, but is the base of the culture of Afghanistan, not the religion, but the culture. To avenge blood, to protect honor, freedom, and equality, to fight to the death for a person who has taken refuge with me, no matter at what price, to defend to the last any property entrusted to me, to be hospitable, to refrain from killing, to pardon offense on the intercession of a woman, and so on. This is the Pashtun Wali. This is when you go to an Afghan's house or enter a tribe, this is how you are treated, at least at the time that we are talking about. Now, things that were added to this later are things that are a little bit troublesome. Pan-Islamism means all the world should be Islamic, or all Islamic nations should band together. Pan-Islamism. Yeah, pan-Turkism, pan, etc. It was brought in by Jamaluddin al-Afghani, and he was actually an Iranian. He's called al-Afghani because he lived in Afghanistan for a while, and he saw the British and how they treated the Muslim world. And he thought that if all Muslims were to band together as a pan form, they might be able to counter the difficulty that they have. So it's an ideology that was involved here and not part of the religion. And later on, the Deobandis from India brought the same thing. And what that creates is xenophobia, which now is directed towards the West, before it was directed towards others, and hatred towards the Shia, because they did not believe that the Shia is actually a religion, and the only religion that existed and Islamic was Sunni. So that was one strand that was added. Then Wahhabism follows the school of Ibn Hanbal. Now there are four schools in Sunni Islam. Wahhabism stands on the strictest side, and the Hanafis that the Afghans are stands on the other side. That is, they are very tolerant, the Hanafis, very reasonable. And the Wahhabis or the Hanbalis are the exact opposite. Now, these two are brought together in Afghanistan and added then another dimension with Wahhabism to... It's a contradictory kind of thing to bring in, to be reasonable about things but not be reasonable at the same time, because that's how sects separate. I say I'm very tolerant and you are not. I go my way, you go your way. Now here we are putting them together. And what we get out of that is Salafism, which is looking back to the time of the Prophet for a model of a good community, anti-Westernism, because that is what we are creating, and fanaticism, which is what the Taliban are and what the Mujahids are. Those who look at this kind of Islam will eventually become. This is, I think, what we have to deal with. Jihadism, there are two types of jihads in Islam. It's a lesser jihad and it's a greater jihad. The greater jihad is against the self. I have to do my best to be a good person, so I have to do my best to do that. Little jihad, lesser jihad, is against the infidels. And that's if Islam is in jeopardy and if a caliph writes a fatwa in that that should be done. And we today don't have a caliph to begin with. The actual caliph died with the Mongols. When they took Baghdad, they killed the last caliph. They reworked the caliphate a number of times, but the last caliph then, again, was put out of business by Ataturk in the 1920s, 1923-4. So there is no caliph to give a fatwa for us to go to jihad. But jihadism is added. And what that brings is brings warfare into this mix, narcotic trade in order for the war to go on, and indiscriminate use of mines of precious stones. So when we look at ideology there, we'll see Islam itself is not the problem. What is the problem is ideologies that as of the beginning of the 20th century are gradually added as belief systems to this belief. And when, of course, if I were to go through this system, I would be the same as the Taliban if they told me that this is the real religion and you should be like that. But who am I to say no? What we need to tell the people is that here is Islam, and here are the accessories. These are the things that are actually working against Islam and bringing people's mind to the kinds of things that they are set to go to. So I hope that answers your question.
Wow, it's fascinating. We have a question in the back here.
Actually, it was a perfect lead into my question, which is that it seems that the fundamental problem is this splintering of Islam, or the use of misuse of Islam to oppose modernity, and that leads us into the Taliban. It leads us into all of these other conflicts because of the mobility that we've got through anywhere in the world in terms of being able to someone to decide to act and take out his passions against whoever he chooses to. So, and we're obviously trying to, as a society, both the U.S. and Western Europe, trying to counter that. But I guess the fundamental question is, who steps in and says, this is Islam? Who can communicate that, or is it a lost cause to try to communicate that across the diverse nature of the Islamic world?
Well, it's not a lost cause, and there are great efforts, I think, afoot to do something about that. In October, I went to Tajikistan, particularly for this purpose, that there was a conference on Imam Abu Hanifa, the tolerant, reasonable imam. And the president of Tajikistan, who has written 3 books himself on Abu Hanifa, presided over 460 scholars from around the world to discuss the tolerance and reasonability of Imam Hanifa. Now, if we have education at the higher level like that, and then at lower levels to teach those who are teaching the kind of Islam that exists, and that is what is being taught in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, around the world. If we can stop this kind of Islam, and we can tell people what true Islam is, and we do not forget that the people we are dealing with are Muslims, that is the thing that we always forget. And I think we should not forget. We should educate the Muslims as good Muslims first. Now, if somebody wants to change and do something different, that is fine. There's a line between modernism and Islam. Islam has no problem with modernism. A better life everybody would like to have. So I think the major problem we have is with education. If we were to find ways to stop the schools in Pakistan that creates the kinds of Muslims that we are dealing with, that would be a first step. And then around the world, if we were to teach teachers what actually Islam is rather than what they teach as Islam, I think that would be a good place. In other words, it took many years for us to get here. It's going to take that many years and more for us to get back to where we were. We've seen Afghans, like everyone else, can build a society, can have a good life, and can enjoy it. We saw it in the 1920s, we saw it in the 1960s. So it's not the Afghans. It is us as those who are teaching them what they need to do. And sometimes we are not right. Or our purpose in doing what we are doing is not what it should be.
Recently, the United States started rearming the Mujahideen, and I'm wondering if you could just explain a little bit about the difference between the Taliban and the Mujahideen.
The Taliban, excuse me. The Taliban and the Mujahideen. The Taliban were zealot students in Pakistan, in refugee camps. And they were taught the type of Islam that I'm talking about. And Mujahideen are the Afghans who were against the communist takeover of their country. So that is a difference. The Mujahideens were fighters for their culture and country and Islamic way of life. The Taliban, on the other hand, want to bring a particular type of religion in, which is the religion I just looked at, with all the additions. If we didn't have this religion, none of the prohibitions that I, maybe some of them would be there, but of the type that I just outlined here would not exist. That is the difference.
We have a question in the back, over on the right.
Hi. How are we, you're talking generations and generations of education before there's any possible move forward. And so right now the United States is looking at putting a little bit of money and a few troops in there. It sounds like it's going to be a quagmire, not a whole lot different than Vietnam. And you're talking about education, but there isn't even schools. It sounds like they've been destroyed. How is this going to happen?
Well, a magic wand might help. I don't know. It is what we have created. I think if the Soviets had left Afghanistan the way they had it in the 60s and not tried to include it, and of course if Iranians had not had a revolution and become zealot Muslims and all of that, things wouldn't be where they are. But the way things are, I think it's going to take a while.
We have a question in the back here.
You talked about the concept of, you know, true Muslims and this piece that's being added on to it by
yes.
Taliban and some of the recent teachings. But it seems you look at history that religions have changed all along the way. And it seems that, and I'd be interested in your comments, as this is an intra-Muslim discussion, conflict that is going on, but it may be that 100 years from now, the true Muslims are what the Taliban are if they turn out to win the ideological war that is going on with this community. And so my question to you is, what is the thought process between these two Muslim groups, and where does that actually seem to be going? Because at least as Westerners, we don't hear very much about this internal conflict.
Well, the Taliban type of thinking is related only to a small group of Muslims who are mostly today on the internet discussing things with each other and creating new ways of looking at Islam. The body of the Islamic world is Sunni, basically, and follows the four schools. And the Shiites have their own way of life and treat things a little bit differently than the Sunnis. But the Taliban we're talking about, or the Taliban thinking at this point, is not very big. There is no discussion as yet, and that's what I'm hoping to happen, is by understanding what the Taliban's do in their teaching and kind of put that aside for people and move more in the direction of a more Muhammadi, as it were, kind of Islam, that things may not be as difficult as they are. It's a long process. It is something that is at international levels that we have to deal with, because there are Muslims all over the world. And not all are Taliban, not all are thinking along these lines. But gradually, if we allow this, in Britain, for example, in France and so forth, this kind of thing is being taught. And people have to be aware of what is an ideology, what is an opinion, and that all of these are not Islamic beliefs that we have to adhere to.
My question is that during the past 6 months, the determination of how to go forward in terms of the United States policy with regard to Afghanistan, clearly one of the options was to withdraw. and that was a serious option that was not did not prove to be acceptable. But it seems to me that option has not been taken off the table. It's still there. What happens, in your opinion, if that comes to pass?
If that comes to pass, we'll see the world of the Taliban all over again. That's why we went in, to prevent that. And if we were to pull out, it will come back. Afghanistan will be the Afghanistan of the Taliban. Well, we went to eliminate Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda and Taliban are related. Al-Qaeda, to me, is the international arm of the Taliban. So we are not talking about two different things. We're talking about the same thing anchored one place and does its work elsewhere. So when we are talking about Taliban, we are talking about Al-Qaeda of Afghanistan, for example. When we are talking about the same group that moves from here now to Yemen, we call them Al-Qaeda, although they are the same people going there doing whatever it is. They may go to Somalia. They may go to Morocco. They are called Al-Qaeda then.
Question back.
Yes.
What is the literacy rate and level of education like in Afghanistan now?
I don't think there is a count, but I would say it's very, very low.
If you could speak with President Obama, what would your advice to him be regarding his administration strategy in Afghanistan today?
I think the strategy that he has is a reasonable strategy. I would say that he should arrange it so that only Afghans who are capable be at helm. And that would be the Afghan tribal chiefs and warlords. Now, there are very good warlords. We always talk about them as really bad guys. But they are not all. They are all people who are very much interested in the well-being of their tribe. And if they were to manage things in the tribes, and somebody other than Karzai oversee those who deal with the urban centers. Karzai, to me, is just the mayor of Kabul. So we need a number of mayors, but we need good mayors. We need the money that is sent to Afghanistan to reach the Afghans. That's not happening. My hope is that they have looked into this and that distribution of funds would be done correctly, and if that is the case, maybe there will be a good chance of getting people jobs, getting people education, and what we think is a very difficult thing and probably never going to happen kind of thing will happen.
We have a question over on the left again here.
How do you square do you discount the Wahhabi influence in particularly in Saudi Arabia in terms of being a fundamental force toward and the Saudi government supported the Wahhabi education as a fundamental source of that fundamentalist Islam?
It is not that Saudi Arabia is supporting that. Saudi Arabia is that. Yeah. Saudi Arabia is a Wahhabi state. And it's one of the most strict of the states, and it's a very rich state, and it has a long hand, and it's spending a lot of funds in all of these countries promoting the kind of thing that I'm talking about.
That's my point. In other words, if that's happening, how is the 400 and some odd people in Tajikistan going to counter that strong influence the Saudi government has reaching all across the world?
Now, 460 that I talked about, these were scholars from throughout the world who came to discuss Abu Hanifa, and to go back like I am here standing before you talking about Abu Hanifa, who he is, what kind of Islam he brought, to the people and what is true Islam. So those were just delegates to a conference like we are here. They're not going to change anything big. But what I say, if other countries, the United States especially, had forums like this to discuss these matters, to sort out things that are Islamic and not Islamic, to include them in textbooks and writings and articles and so forth, so people read and see what is going on in the schools in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, then we have the beginning of a different education for Muslims and for others to know what Islam is. And I'm sure that tensions would be much less when we know each other better.
Good question in the back here. Yeah.
I would like to know more about the relationship between Iran and Afghanistan, and what are the interests of the Iranian government in the outcome in Afghanistan?
The Iranians are in support of the government of Afghanistan and are against the Taliban. As I said, the Taliban are, to begin with, the strictest brand of Sunni Islam, and to a degree they don't recognize the Iranian Shiites as Muslim. So with the government they are okay, with the Taliban they are not.
In the back here, please.
One of the questions we seem to have danced around to, a question that I have, is why are we in Afghanistan and what do you think we should be doing there? What are we doing there? Are we there to prevent a spread into Pakistan, to prevent atomic weapons falling into the hands of the jihadists? Or what are we doing there? Or should we just be there at all?
I think under this situation that the world is, we should be there. Maybe it's a question to ask State Department more than me, but the British were in Afghanistan a long time before us for a purpose. And the Soviets were in Afghanistan for a purpose. And we are there for a purpose. If we do not stem the tide of what is going on in that part of the world today, we will very soon face all of those people that they want to recruit, that they want to bring into fruition against us at our door. So there is no question that we have to be there. There is no question that we have to do our best to do the best we can do there. And Pakistan, you mentioned, is one of the most troubling spots on the world today because of the nuclear arsenal that they have, and it is so close to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
You know, I have a question. This has been a really enlightening discussion, a really serious discussion. Are there, as we try to make sense out of what is going on in that part of the world and what our own government is involved in there, are there strands of hope that you think we should be looking at that hold some promise at this stage?
I think there are. I'm, of course, an optimist. Maybe you shouldn't listen to me, but there are.
You can tell I am too.
I think the way they have started is good. As I said, if they go about doing what they have said to force the Karzai government to do what it needs to do or replace it, I think we are on the way to progress. If the funds that are sent there reaches those who should, and if the troops are enlightened enough to understand who the Afghans are and why we are there, and if the Afghans understand again what our purpose there is, I think that will be again a positive thing. Once these happen, I think things will be much better.
We'll keep our eye on that. And we have one last question in the back.
Why is China not involved in this? Why do the Talibans don't threaten China?
Uh,
Good question.
I should have ended it one earlier, huh?
I think so. I really haven't looked at the Taliban relation with China, although I should say in that part of the world, the things are, say, in Indonesia and around there as bad as they are elsewhere. But in China, per se, I cannot tell you.
You know, I think all of us want to thank you for your role in education, and we're all obviously believers in that. And in particular, thank you for educating us
Surely.
Tonight so deeply. And continue good luck
thank
with your
you.
Work.
Thank you. Thank you.